So myself and Jose today, we're going to talk to you about some of the problems that we have with the network and some of the things we've been doing to solve it. Within Facebook infrastructure, and more specifically Facebook network engineering, we strive to have a zero impact network. All very well, but what the hell does that actually mean? So if we're resolving issues as quickly as possible, and hopefully even predicting issues before they happen, you guys that are using the site should never actually notice. So today we're going to be talking about some general numbers of scale, both around Facebook and our network. We're going to be talking about FDN, anybody playing buzzword bingo, Facebook defined networking, some of the tooling that we use within our alerting and monitoring pipeline. We're going to go over some tales from the real world, and then we're going to go over some goals and points we've learned along the way. And then at the end, if we've got some time, we'll go for some Q&A. So scale. There's more than 1.3 billion people that use the site every single month. And whilst that's a really good number, the number that's perhaps more interesting is the fact that over 80% of those are actually outside of the US and Canada. But what does that actually mean? Well, our network, as you saw yesterday in Joel's talk, we have data centers all throughout the US and Europe. And then we have POPs even further afield than that. So our network does really go to all four corners of the world. So, hang on one second. Don't know how that happened. Ignore that slide, it didn't happen. So, if we look at this graph here of, along the bottom we have machine to user traffic and machine to machine traffic along the top. This is a traffic graph of around a 12 to 18 month time period. What we can see is the machine to user traffic, whilst it is growing, which is good, it's growing at a rate that, you know, we can deal with it. You know, the capacity guys can spin up more capacity, more links, that's good. But the machine-to-machine traffic, that's growing exponentially. And that means we're having to add more and more capacity. The network's growing more and more every single day. Within network engineering, we like to say that we build and train the robots, and then we let those run the network. Because at the end of the day, who wants to do the monotonous stuff that you do, you know, 1,000 times a day? Facebook-defined networking. So as I mentioned, some of the tooling that we use for our monitoring and alert pipeline, as you can see here, there's a bunch of names you probably have no idea what the hell they mean, and I'd love to go into all of them, but we don't have enough time today. So I'm going to go into just a few of these. The first of those is FBNet. FBNet is a database to model absolutely everything within the Facebook network. It allows us to monitor and model devices, line cards within those devices, ports on those line cards, circuits that connect those ports to other ports, BGP neighbors, MPLS LSPs, and operational data around network events. Drain services. These are things that allow us to take production traffic off both data center and backbone devices, whether it be because there's an issue or we're doing planned maintenance. NetNORAD. NetNORAD is a system that allows us to continuously monitor the network for packet loss between cluster and cluster and region to region. To do this, it's continuously sending traffic with multiple different traffic classes to ensure that we get all of the different QoS queues in between the network. And we have Megazord. Megazord is an alarm correlation engine that allows us to take multiple different alarms and correlate them to one major alarm. This can be correlating on things we know about it, such as the location, the vendor, things like that. So when we come back to this, if we look over towards the left-hand side, we have the sources of this alerting and monitoring pipeline. We have FBNet that I've mentioned, Syslog and SNMP traps, which everybody knows, and ODS, which is our live key value store, to store things such as the rate of traffic through a particular interface. And on the right-hand side, we have the actual consumers of this. So Megazord, as I talked about, and a few other tools. So let's move on and we'll go on to some tales from the real world. As anybody that's operated a network of any scale, or perhaps even of not real any scale, running circuits can be a pain. So everybody starts off with the manual approach of you find out from a vendor that you've got some maintenance and we wake up at 2 a.m. and you drain the circuits, and then once the maintenance is done, you check everything's okay and then you move the traffic back on. That's cool when you've got 1, 10, maybe even 50 circuits, but it doesn't really continue to scale. So you move on to the hybrid approach, using some of the tools that we've created to make the moving of traffic more automated. But yet again, you've got to have people sat in front of the computer pressing the buttons. But doing that, again, when I say we've got a really global network, it means that we don't have one particular time window to do this in. You know, what is off-peak inside Europe is peak in Asia, vice versa. So where did we actually move from there? Well, we fully automated this, so now we don't have to worry about it at all. So let's say we receive a notification from a particular vendor saying they're going to do maintenance on a set of circuits. We're going to take that and we're going to pass all the information from inside it, such as the time it's going to happen, the time it's going to finish, what circuits are going to be affected, and perhaps even whether we can expect downtime or not. We're going to put all that information inside a task so that we can use that with other tools. We're going to move on to a tool used called Poltergeist, which is basically a more advanced version of Cron that's able to act on tasks and tags within those tasks. And it's going to call the drain tools that I mentioned. Those are going to take the traffic away from those production circuits so that we can carry out the maintenance. Once the maintenance has ended, Poltergeist is again going to step in and it's going to attempt to move the traffic back. Before it does this, it carries out a series of audits to actually ensure that it really is safe to move traffic back onto these. So are the things even up? Are there any CRCs on it? So on and so forth. And finally, once it's deemed that it is safe, we're going to use the drain tools to put traffic back on there. Now that's all well and good if you know about it and you've been given weeks of notice, but what if you actually haven't been given notice that this is going to happen? So let's say we have a number of circuits that go down. We're going to use Megazord to correlate these. We're going to look at them. We're going to look at the vendor that these are for. We're going to look at where these are between. And we're going to put all that inside OpperDB. OpperDB is a sub-database within FBNet that allows us to store operational events such as these fiber cuts. We're then going to go to FBNet and look up how do we actually contact the vendor that's involved in these. Create a task with all these details, which is both for the on-call guy to look at if he needs to, and also so that we can track any things that we need to do. We're going to contact the vendor. If possible, this is going to be via an automated method, however they choose, email, APIs, whatever, or in some cases, you have to pick up the phone, unfortunately, but we're going to go into that. And now, once the vendor's completed their work and, you know, everything's restored, vendors is continuously checking FBNet and checking the snapshots that we have within FBNet of the current state of the network to see whether those circuits are actually back up, they're running okay. And once that has happened, we're going to move into a hold down period. This hold down period allows us to ensure that things truly are stable, they're not flapping, not can go down again after half an hour. And once that has happened and we've finished the monitoring period, we're going to close out and everything's going to be good. I'm going to hand over now to my colleague Jose, who's going to talk to you some more about some of the other trials and tribulations we've had inside the network.
Thank you, David. So David has basically described two common scenarios that most enterprises and most large companies face. We have described how we went from the basic approach that everybody does to moving this to be completely automated. So now let's see a more uncommon example of how automation can actually help the situation. So if we look at this, this is what we have lovingly called the memory leak debacle. As we can see from this graph, we have a series of routers that through a period of time, I think it's 4 months, essentially have been leaking memory. So as we can see from this graph, free memory decreases quite rapidly, in some cases in a week, in other devices every 2 weeks, in other devices every 3 weeks. Something happens, essentially we apply a workaround, and the device comes back into what we call a healthy state. So not doing this workaround essentially meant that those devices would eventually get to a state where they would be unmanageable and they would fail essentially completely. This meant that we couldn't manage them. This meant that they would start dropping packets. And in some cases, it would even affect other networking devices. Fixing the root cause of the memory leak would involve the vendor. And as you can see from this graph, it took quite a long time. So how would you solve the situation with humans? Well, essentially, with the slide that didn't exist, which was lots of them and coffee. How did we actually attack this with automation? Well, essentially with some of the tools that David described. So let's go through this process step by step. We have our key store value that's essentially gathering with what we call collections, gathering this information and a whole set of metrics from these devices, including free memory. And we have what we call detectors, which is essentially a piece of code that you are able to, you know, insert what do you want an alarm to fire on, which is like, you know, I want this if this goes above a certain threshold, below a certain threshold, or if condition A, B, C happens at the same time, generate an alarm. So we basically define one for free memory, when the device went below what we denominated the safe threshold. So an alarm gets generated. This alarm gets picked up by our automated human, which is essentially FBAR. And FBAR will run the remediation for that particular alarm. The remediation is essentially a piece of Python code that has all the checks and all the steps you should follow in order to bring the device back into a safe state, which in this case means that there's a series of pre-checks to check that, you know, you can actually, you know, the device is in the state that you expected it to be, essentially that the device is actually in the, below this threshold, that the device has hardware redundancy, that the capacity on the network is enough, because to do this, to do the workaround is quite intrusive, and we actually drain the devices when this happens. So if everything is well, FBAR would call the drain services, which David described. The drain services would do their own set of checks and their own set of tasks to take traffic off the device. If everything goes well, the device would get drained, and we would start the workaround for this problem. The workaround for this problem, these devices are large routers, and they have essentially two CPUs. I'm not going to get into the vendor terminology to protect them from public shaming, but essentially they have two CPUs. One of them is active, the other one is standby. The workaround for this is essentially to reload both of those CPUs to get the device back into a clean state. So the active CPU would be reloaded, the standby CPU would take over, FBAR would wait until the redundancy recovered, basically that CPU rebooted, came back, synchronized again, that we have no weird errors, we have no weird messages, everything is green. When this happened, we would reload the standby CPU, we would we'll do the same wait, we would do the same process, we would hold until this happened again. If everything was okay and if the post checks actually pass, FBAR would essentially call the drain service to bring traffic back into that device. And essentially this went on for 4 months. This gave us gave the vendor the agility and gave the vendor the time to actually be able to fully understand what was the root cause of this issue and actually address it in a way that this could never happen again. And this basically required no human. No human was ever involved in fixing this device, this set of devices from the network in a period of 4 months. So to give you guys an idea of some of the scale and some of the utility of these tools, we have some numbers, right? And this is the same graph that David described. And you know, on the left, we have essentially sources of alarms or sources of information. And on the right, we have consumers. We can see that, for example, we have our alarm manager engine there, which is where the alarms go. And then, for example, FBAR picks them up and then goes and does processing with them, right? So to give you an idea about some rough numbers, some average in 30 days, I'm not going to go through all the systems, but let's say the most interesting ones, we have the emitter, which is our engine that processes, you know, notifications from networking devices, processes in 30 days around 3 billion notifications, and only 1% of them end up being alarms. FBAR, which, as I said before, is our automated human, actually would act 750,000 times on networking alarms, resolving 99.6% of them. We would automatically handle 300 planned maintenances. We will handle 1,100 networking events, which is essentially the shark having fun. And Megasort would correlate hundreds of thousands of alarms into what we call master alarms, which essentially, you know, we have, you know, when a device goes down, you have all these dependencies that fail. So Megasort would actually look at all of them and say, hey, you know, like the root cause of this event is, you know, this happened, right? Like this device went down or one of the CPUs is dead or whatever the event is. And the interesting thing about all of this is that this has given us the ability to have essentially a single on-call in charge of the whole network. And we are heavily moving in the direction of having no on-call. I mean, as I said, for example, that horrible memory leak situation was completely handled by robots. I mean, the instructions were there, so in case one of those steps or one of those logics failed because whatever reason, right? You needed to drain this device, and for whatever reason you didn't have enough capacity, or a library fail, or whatever it is, a human would get involved, a human would get notified, because obviously we didn't want the device going into this very bad, very unhealthy state. But that didn't happen in 4 months. I mean, we learned some lessons in the first couple of days, those were patched, and then this was handled until we actually got the fix for the root cause. So let's talk about some of the lessons that we have learned and some of the recommendations that we have based on our experience with all of this. The first one is to reuse tools and reuse code when possible and when it makes sense. There are some organizations, there are some people that have this tendency of trying to reinvent or rewrite everything. Some of the components that we saw here are components that are Facebook-wide. They're used by everyone in infra. Some of these components were created specifically to meet our needs. And for example, in the case of Megasort, which was written by David, and it was written specifically for networking need, interesting enough, after this was done and it was put in production, we found out that the DBA team actually had a use case that they could solve using Megasort, and they started using the application. So this is kind of a philosophy that we have ongoing. Recommendation number two is that hacks quickly become important tools. And what we mean by this is that we have seen this happen in multiple occasions where someone during an incident, because they need to have the agility and they need to have an answer to a question very fast, they go and they develop this, you know, a quick hack, a quick Python script or a quick bash script or whatever, and somebody else sees this and says, oh, this is really useful, we should, you know, develop this more into a tool. And you know, some of the tools you're seeing here today actually started as that, right? Like, this was really useful during this event. Can we have this happen automatically all the time, everywhere, right? And that's, for example, how some of the audits that we have come up, right? We didn't imagine this failure scenario, or we didn't imagine, like, you know, if all these 16 things happen at once, it's a bad time. So now we actually have code to go detect that, right? Number three is that we try not to have code owners in the sense of, well, I or David developed Megasort, so David is the only one that touches that code base, and he's the only one that actually will work on it. But so we try to encourage everyone to actually, you know, if you want a feature and you're able to do it and you're inclined to do it, you know, try to do it, and that's perfectly fine. But in order to do this effectively, you need to have instrumentation, you need to have unit tests, and you need to document all the things. Even if you develop something that you actually nobody else is going to code on, if 6 months down the line you are doing what we sometimes call as code archaeology, which is essentially like, well, why is this written this way, right? If you have this information, it's a lot easier, even for yourself. Number four is poke for feedback often. And this is an interesting lesson that, you know, some of the tools that we have, even though we develop them, we are not the primary user. The primary user sometimes are people doing deployments, sometimes are people in the data center, sometimes are people that are actually replacing or moving stuff around. So interesting enough, we have, as you saw before, we have systems that do automatic drains, we have systems that, you know, hey, this device looks unhealthy, now you're no longer in the network, and all of this is automatic, right? So sometimes when we have investigated, like, oh, why did FBAR did this or did the other thing, we found out, like, well, this wasn't really a failure. This was somebody doing maintenance. And they did the maintenance without actually setting this device as, hey, device, you are doing a plain maintenance, right? And we have tools to cover all these workflows. So in one of these cases, actually, when I spoke with the person that actually did the maintenance, and that person actually, and I told them, why are you not using tool X? Tool X covers all of this. You wouldn't have to do all this manual work. It would be consistent. You know, talk to me. And essentially, this person told me, well, the problem is I don't use that tool because it's too slow for me. Right? It would take me twice the time. And this is feedback that was, you know, we didn't have, right? So after I had that conversation with him, I was like, well, but tell me specifically, like, what parts or what do you think can be improved? And I actually went back, made the tool better, and they started using it, right? But if you don't talk with the end users, you never know. Number five is an interesting one that we have learned the hard way, which essentially networking devices don't have powerful CPUs. And what do I mean by this? Some of the people in my team actually come from a server environment, and servers these days tend to be very powerful. A typical server will have multiple CPUs, so CPUs will have dozens of cores. So you can get away with doing, you know, very interesting stuff. You can get away with getting a whole set of counters every second, every 10 seconds, whatever. If you try to do this on network devices, it's usually a bad time. And we try to do this with networking devices because, you know, like everyone, we really like data, and we really like to get that data as up-to-date as possible because this allows our automated systems to react, you know, very quickly. So when doing this, you know, there's some systems, for example, we're doing 50 collections. Collections essentially going, gathering a set of counters, right? And we actually saw that by tweaking how this was done, by doing optimizing, there were some set of router devices that we could actually reduce the CPU load on them 30%. So this is an interesting thing to have because, you know, if over time you write 100 collections and each one of those collections eats 1% more or increases the CPU usage 1% more, right? Like, this kind of creeps on you, right? Number six, the sooner the robots take over, the better. The robots have allowed us to, as you saw, continue to scale, continue to have a bigger and bigger network without having to scale the actual human side. We are having to have, you know, a team of 300 network engineers. So number seven, talk is cheap, focus on impact. And what we're saying here is, as I said before, we try to encourage our users and we try to encourage our engineers to, if they want a feature request or if they see, oh, this has a bug or this should be different or like you should tweak this or tweak that, to actually go ahead and do it. Ideas are plentiful, but actually getting something out the door tends to count more. And the last one is that done is better than perfect. Another interesting thing that we have found out is that getting something, as I said before, getting something out the door that covers maybe 90% of your use case or 95% of your use case, and then iterating over that and learning mistakes and actually, you know, moving closer to that 100% tends to be better than spending 6 months whiteboarding some system to cover, you know, out of the bat the 100% of your use cases without having to suffer through those 6 months. We told you about what we have in prod and what we, you know, our experience. Let's tell you something a little bit about what we're doing today, like what we are, you know, investing on in the near future. Well, as some of you might be aware, we release our own top of the rack. We release our own operating system for networking devices. We release what could be called as a network chassis using those components. So my team is very focused on making sure that from an operational perspective, we have the same visibility that we have with every other platform, that we have the same coverage, that we have the same level of access to the ASICs, that we have essentially parity. So this is something that we are actively working on. Another interesting one that we are doing is that we are bridging the gap between the optical world, between the DWDM world and the IP world. These are, have been always two areas have been completely separated. Most of the time in large companies they're managed by completely different people with completely different systems. When essentially it's, you know, it's all integrated and it, you know, if you have a large scale failure and you lost a bunch of capacity, it's this kind of useful to understand, hey, you just lost, you know, 100 links or 200 links because they all go through this particular fiber path and this is how this is mapped out and here's the alarm on the actual optical gear. So we're trying to integrate all of this to make sure that we have full coverage in our tools and that we have that visibility to, you know, minimize the time of the time they have, we have to spend for troubleshooting on this type of events. The third thing that we're working that's interesting is PCE, which means path computational element, which is taking the brains out of the routers. As we know, each router on a typical network is actually doing their own thing. They are calculating based on the information they get from the other devices. So now we are focusing more and more, because this gives us more flexibility, into actually having controller-type solutions where the devices, you know, can have their own brain, but they're typically, you know, like large-scale decisions based on things like latency or bandwidth or et cetera are actually upgraded, are actually pushed by a controller. And finally, is we are continuous to maintain and to upgrade these tools. This means new feature requests, this means bug fixes, because it's a very important part of this. You develop a system, and if you're not doing this maintenance, you run into the scenario where, for example, in the case of the data center folks, the tool wasn't fast enough for them. The tool was doing its job perfectly fine, but it wasn't fast enough. Or, for example, as in the case of collections, where by doing small tweaks, we found that, hey, we could offload the CPU of a large part of our routers, 40%. So thank you very much for your time. I leave you with one question.
Cheers to talk, guys. Great. Do we have any questions?
Not a single question.
No.
Everybody's too asleep. That's what it is.
This is where I think of that.
Hi. Okay. I understood from your talk that you are not still. You didn't introduce a Facebook operating system in the edge routers. You know, like the six pack and the wedge. You are not using your own. You're using Juniper or Cisco vendors?
We are, like everyone, large enough, we have everyone, right?
But my question is, so you still don't manage the routers using Thrift, or do you, or how you?
Yeah, FBOS. Devices are in FBOS are using Thrift. They have no CLI, for example.
Excellent. I was curious about the level of automation Do you find that people are more willing to accept substandard software, shall we say, if it's easy to deploy a workaround and fix and have robots like poke memory and the likes?
Yeah, so we, as Jose mentioned, we try to ship early, ship often. It's a lot easier to ship something that might be a little frayed around the edges at first and then get feedback as to what's broken, because at the end of the day, I can sit in a room for 6 months and code something and I think, yes, it's brilliant, it's the best code ever, but it's not. And as soon as I deploy it to production, all these holes are going to start be found in it. And it's easier to get that out the door straight away, get feedback early, and make those changes with bugs that I necessarily haven't found in my unit tests or in my own testing.
Hello, hi. Actually, two questions. The first one, looking at the robots you present in your diagram, it seems to me that's quite a reactive robots. Do you have any plan or idea or what you're opinion on develop kind of the proactive robots to predict kind of fault before it even happens?
Yes, we have automation at all stages. We have automation to, for example, predict capacity crunches. So they do, you know, machine learning, and they do prediction based on if this continues this way for the next 2 months or the next 3 months, or I don't remember the time period of time, you're going to have a problem here, you're going to have a problem here, you're going to have a problem here. And so they go to the team that can fix this, you know, the team that's very qualified to fix this, so they get ahead of this. And for example, with the detectors, is some of that is this, right? Like if you have this change in behavior after a rollout of new code or whatever, right? Or you know, we do tweaks on the backbone for like different knobs, right? Mm. If you have this adverse effect, hey, generate alarms, right? So we have a lot of alarms. We have much more alarms than robots, right? Okay. So we have, yes.
But what is the limitation of this predict function? What's the false positive or the false negative you can accept actually?
It gets tweaked a lot, right? So there's people that maintain those tools very actively, and you know, it's like everything. The more you iterate, the better it gets.
Mm. Okay. So the second question is actually about the PCE element you are talking about. It seems to me it's much like the SDN, what you are actually talking about, because you are actually taking the intelligence from the, you know, all the routing algorithm and you are integrating into kind of controller, so that the switches are just, or routers are just a dumb machine, so they don't do any decisions. Is that, why don't you just use the SDN?
It basically is SDN.
It's SDN.
Like, without using words like cloud and synergy and converged solutions, we didn't want to really go into that. And at the end of the day, PCE, you know, whether it's a solution from Cisco or whoever your vendor is, like, underneath the hood, they're using PCE.
Mm. But it does not use the OpenFlow protocols.
No.
It's not standardized. Like.
Yeah.
All right.
So for the most part, it's just programming whatever devices we have. And as Jose said, we have every vendor out there. Mm. It's working out a way to do those agnostically without, you know, not everybody supports OpenFlow, for instance.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Good catch.
So I'm curious about the connection between the alerts and the robots. How do you decide which robot or what should happen to fix a given alert? Is it just a simple, like each alert has one robot that takes care of it, or do you have...
It depends, right? I mean, like you try to tackle 90% or 95% of your use cases, right? Like if something that happens, you know, like once every 3 years doesn't have any impact, should that really be an alarm? So for example, in the case of FR has a series of what we call remediations, which is, you know, if any of this happens, this is what it should do. Or this is what a human would do. So robot, go do it, right? And I can continue to read Reddit.
For a specific alert?
So or a group
of
alerts.
Any different possible things that can happen, and do you have
so we have a mapping
recognize...
that allows us to basically say, like, these 10 different types of alerts actually all really are the same thing, and if any of these happen, go and run this remediation. So, you know, you're saying, if these happen, pass it to this robot. If these happen, pass it to this robot. So you just have kind of like a mapping table of these alarm types to this robot.
And that robot might have to do more investigation or anything?
Yeah, exactly. So there might be logic gates inside there to say, like, if you do this and this happens, then chances are actually it was a false alarm and we can forget about it. If you do this and this happens, then oh, you really should put a task to the on-call because this thing is going to about to burn.
Or if you're expecting the sky to be blue and dinosaurs to be there, and there's no dinosaurs and the sky's not blue, get human involved. But that happens less and less. And every time that happens, somebody goes, okay, so we should consider that, gets added into the remediation, or it gets added into all the code. That's the good thing about robots. They are consistent, so the errors happen once.
Okay, we're out of time. Good rest.
Thanks.